everybody. It's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, ChicagoJazz.com, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience. We've got saxophonist Tim Warfield on the show today. Really happy to have him on. He's actually coming into the Jazz Showcase December 19th through the 22nd with a show called Tim Warfield's Jazzy Christmas. So I'm very interested to talk to Tim about that and his new release, Jazzland. Tim, thanks for jumping on for a second.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure.
So let's talk specifically, first off, about the Jazz Showcase gigs you have coming up December 19th through the 22nd. Now, it's Tim Warfield's Jazzy Christmas, and is this something that you've done in the past? Is this a show that you've put on before? And I'm curious about, you know, what Christmas tunes you're going to be playing, or if there's going to be Christmas tunes played on this gig.
This is something that I've absolutely done in the past. I've been doing this program for quite some time, watching it evolve into a recording. The recording came out in late 2012. 2013, it received a really nice write-up in the New York Times. They don't normally write up Christmas records.
Mm-hmm.
But they did do something in their holiday gift guide about like the 20, I think it was like the 10, either 10 or 20 best listens. And my record was one of those records, along with Mary J. Blige and a few other artists. It wasn't just jazz music.
Wow.
And so I was honored and very happy for that to happen. And we will be playing Christmas tunes. it's Christmas tunes reimagined.
Okay, so they're kind of like jazzed up, hipped up versions of maybe some standard tunes that everybody might know, but of course done in the Tim Warfield way.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool. So who else is on the gig? Because looking over the lineup, it looks pretty pretty serious as well.
Yep, it's pretty much like the record. It's Cyrus Chestnut on the piano, Terrell Stafford at the trumpet, Stefan Harris on the vibraphone, Rodney Whitaker on the bass. Clarence Penn, he and I had a miscommunication. So I got Mark Whitfield Jr., who is the son of Mark Whitfield, the guitarist.
I was going to ask that. He's a killer drummer.
He's an amazing drummer. So I'm looking forward to having him. This will be his first time playing with the band. And then I've got a different vocalist than what I have on the record. I heard this young lady last year via a YouTube clip, and I was very impressed by her sense of time, as well as just the resonance of her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Lucy Yegezarian, and she's really good. So mm-hmm. she'll be the vocalist for that time. And so we do half and half, some instrumentals, and then some vocals. But I felt it was really important to have a vocalist
mm-hmm.
as a part of the recording, because I was like, well, all of these songs have words. So it might be a smart thing to do to at least incorporate that idea in part of your record. So that's what I did.
You know, but that's also interesting, because I think a lot of people have heard, you know, I mean, you can do Oscar Peterson Christmas on down, right? I mean, there's a lot of instrumental versions and a lot of instrumental records of Christmas tunes. And then, of course, you get into Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and things like that. But there's not a lot of recordings coming out like with that are, you know, kind of serious jazz swinging stuff with vocalists these days. I mean, you know, you can get some different things, but I just don't find a lot of that stuff. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, well, we're trying to keep it that way. And one of the things that some of the commentary that I've heard before is that when you do hear, those type of records with vocalists, it's, for the lack of a better term, and no disrespect intended, foo-foo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons why jazz Christmas records have gotten, or did have, a bad name. I think it's starting to change a bit now.
Mm-hmm.
As I know I had, I won't say any names, but I had a couple of artists, even prominent ones, contact me about my record and say, hey, you did a Christmas record. You own that, don't you? I was like, yeah. They're like, I think I'm going to copy. So I know there's at least two really prominent artists who have done Christmas records as well. And so, and what you expect from them is really great art, which is what they brought to the table as well.
Well, you know, and as a drummer, I'm just happy now that I know that you've said that, you know, some of the vocal Christmas records are foo-foo. Now, I have license to tell some of these vocalists I play with that, you know, it's kind of foo-foo because Tim Warfield said it was...
No! Don't give me any trouble. Please, don't give me any trouble.
Now, some of these, some of the Christmas tunes and things, I'm always curious when I'm talking to somebody who writes music and composes and obviously plays at such a high level and has toured all over the world and everything. When you get into the Christmas tunes, I mean, there's a couple of different ways to approach it. Did you reimagine some of these tunes, meaning reharmonize, like kind of look at it? Because if you really look at some of the, you know, standard Christmas tunes, I mean, the chord changes aren't all that exactly exciting, especially to play over. So did you have to kind of delve in and say, hey, you know, how can I make this so that it sounds like the tune, but I got to make it a little hipper?
Yes, all of them.
Yeah.
Yes, all of them are done in that way. Some less than others because it wasn't required, or it was that particular song I wanted it to be closer to the original. But all of them are arranged.
Okay. Since we're talking about Christmas, and I also want to talk a little bit about the new release Jazzland, but let's finish up with the Christmas show that's coming into the Jazz Showcase December 19th through the 22nd. You know, for me, I mean, you know, obviously you play Christmas tunes one time a year. You're not playing these in July. So, I mean, there's a shelf life on these every year. But, I mean, is there something about Christmas tunes or something about the holiday music that is it a melody? Is it something along those lines or something that you grab from the past and say, you know what, I really love playing this tune or I really like this tune because of this?
Well, you know, that's actually a really good question. This is how it evolved, because it definitely was an evolution. In my earlier years of playing, I probably wouldn't have thought one bit about a Christmas tune around December. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, and you know, I have this whole concept about jazz musicians' artistry versus popularity via commercial ideas, and how I think an artist should be smart enough to be able to come up with something challenging for yourself, but still have something with some appeal that's going to attract an audience, understanding that music is designed to share with people. So I was doing a gig with somebody, and when we finished playing, we played some song, I think it was like Stella by Starlight or something like that, on Green Dome Street, something. And when we finished, they put the intercom on and Christmas music came on. And it felt so disruptive. Mm-hmm. And I felt so unhip. I was like, man, you're smart enough to be able to come up with some stuff where you guys can, where we as a group can still do what we do, but be current to the moment, be current to the time. And so that's when it started for me. And I only did like maybe one or two tunes, just, and then, you know, just maybe somebody's going to ask, but we're going to play them anyway. And before it's all over, of course, as soon as I played it, people really liked it. And so it got to the point where I kept arranging more and more of them until it became a complete idea. Actually, I had too much material. All of the music that I recorded is not on the recording. I couldn't fit it all on. Oh. But I think I'm going to actually release it via iTunes next year. The rest of it. Yeah.
Cool.
So the beauty of the Christmas, and I'll make it short, but the beauty of it is that playing music that almost everyone has heard since birth allows the listener to really understand conceptually how you think as an artist.
Hmm. Okay. Yep.
And that was really important for me.
That makes a lot of sense.
You know, it's very easy to come in and play your originals. I'm playing my originals and I'm being slick and I'm playing slick stuff over my originals, but you don't really know what they are.
Yeah, well,
so you don't know if I'm playing slick or not. So I realized an immediacy just from the response how important that is.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I know you're also a professor in school and you do a lot of teaching and everything in addition to playing. And I'm always one, and since you, we'll go down this little wormhole here for a second, because I think it's important, especially when I'm talking to somebody like you, and there's a lot of, you know, musicians that listen to this podcast and also a lot of music fans as well. But I think it's interesting. I mean, just from a standpoint of you playing wise, how important is it for musicians to know jazz standards or know where the music came from? Because, you know, a lot of kids coming out of college, they might know some of that stuff. They read the fake books. They do all that. They don't have it internalized like you have it internalized. And then they write their own music and start to compose their own music. And I always think that's interesting to hear a perspective from somebody like you on how important it is to probably be able to draw and know where this music came from, like, you know, really, really ingrained in your system.
Yeah, I think it's of dire importance. And for a couple of a really basic reason, addressing the popular standard versus the jazz standard. Popular standards weren't written for jazz, and it's really all about intent. They were written for a voice, and there were plenty of popular standards written, a bunch of them probably simultaneously, because they were in competition. You know, you have all of these songwriters trying to bid to get, you know, their music to be a part of some movie or some play. You know, the beauty of that, or I think the most important thing about that, is because the intent of the composition was to accentuate or to work in a positive manner with the voice. It's all about the voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea of the song, and which is why they all have words. Well, that teaches you as an instrumentalist how to sing, because the intent, the thought process about it was all about the voice. It had nothing to do with a sharp 9 chord or flat 7. It had nothing to do with anything like that. And I think a lot of times we get so caught up that we don't realize we sound like a bundle of symmetrical patterns and licks, mm-hmm, and intervals, which is beautiful to be able to have that level of proficiency. But you're not saying anything. You're probably navigating through the harmony quite well, you know, but that's not really what soloing is about. Soloing is about telling a story. And I know that that's a verbiage that you don't hear probably often enough these days to describe musician solos. You hear words like shredding the changes.
Mm-hmm.
and then you wonder why people aren't checking you out. I was like, okay, so who's really going to shred changes more than John Coltrane? I was like, why are you thinking like this? There's a better way to think about this. Let's think about music from its most basic form, as a ritual of commune, like one of the fundamental rituals of commune we have as human beings, like dancing and storytelling and breaking bread. Like, once you kind of understand how music is really supposed to function with human beings, it'll make you rethink your program.
Mm. That makes a ton of sense. And when you bring that up and telling a story, it reminds me of the first time I heard Dexter Gordon. And listening to Dexter, you know, I mean, because a lot of guys shred and a lot of guys, you know, can play fast. And, you know, obviously, you know, John Coltrane is telling his own story and Wayne Shorter. But I mean, something that really caught my ear and I wanted to get your opinion on that is, like, Dexter Gordon would play long solos, but he just continuously, it made sense for him to keep going because his story wasn't over. It felt like
it wasn't over. It was beautiful. And he did it with a big guttural, just cool, literally cool sound.
Yeah. Oh man, what a sound, huh? So let's talk a little bit about the new recording, Jazzland, and looking over some of the tunes on there. You have some originals, it looks like, and obviously you have some, probably some of your favorites. I mean, you've got things from Wayne Shorter and Lou Donaldson, but then you also have a tune on there, Ode to Billy Joe, who That tune, I love that tune, by the way, too. But it's interesting to me because there's quite a mixture of different styles or different tunes, I should say, on here. It's not just kind of like, you know, right down the list, whether it's all originals or kind of standards and things like that. So what was the selection process-wise on this? Did it have to do with who's on the album? And we should talk about that, too. Why don't we talk about who's on the album first and then go back into the tunes?
Okay. Well, we have, of course, Terrell Stafford, who's my partner in crime.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long standing music relationship as well as a friendship. Of course, the great Pat Bianchi on organ, as well as Byron Landham on drums, and Daniel Sedanik at the percussion. And we've been a group performing for quite some time now. This is our, I guess it's our third. Is it our third record?
I think that sounds right from what I was looking at. Yeah,
it's our third. It seems like it should be more for the amount of time. But I bounced around, and you know, I have different projects, so.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to try to sustain the mood, you know, keep everybody working and keep me working. The fast answer is that really I had three projects, and I had to make a decision. I had three ideas about projects.
Hmm.
One was I was going to do a recording of all spirituals because there's a direct correlation between that jazz music and the Hammond B3 organ. So the ideas are simpatico. So I wanted to kind of come up with new ideas about how to play them. And then I wanted to do a bunch of groove music with unconventional harmony. But I still wanted that feeling of you know, that sort of soulful, groovy feeling to be there. Mm-hmm. And so that would include originals as well. I'm trying to think what else. Oh, and then I wanted to do a recording of music from the 70s. And like 60s, late 60s, all of the 70s. I was going to do some music like that and redo it because I truly believe some of the greatest logic and songwriting still comes from that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I sat down and thought about it and said, yeah, you want all of those to be on there. So I was like, you don't want to narrow the idea. I'm saying I'm doing this, I'm only doing this, or I'm only doing that. I mean, there are times for projects of that nature, but I was like, why don't we just do a record like they used to do records? Put songs on. try to cover everybody, you know, try to touch everybody. And, you know, maybe someone who only wants to hear Old Billy Joe might be touched by Wade in the Water.
Mm-hmm.
Or touched by Tenderly, which is, I think that's just a better way to do it. So that's what I do.
Well, you know, and the thing I love the mixture of tunes on here because really there's something for everybody. And like what you said, somebody might catch Ode to Billy Joe or somebody might catch Tenderly and come on and all of a sudden find the other tunes and be inspired by that. And it's on Crisscross. So looking at Crisscross's website and looking at where it's located, I love the marketing of it because the sentence before the tune list, over the course of 69 minutes, this group of mid-career modern masters offers a state-of-the-art view of inspired 21st century groove-focused improvisation. That pretty much says it all, I would imagine, right?
Ted Pankin, that's the great Ted Pankin. He always, he's a wordsmith for sure, always does it correctly.
So what is it like? Because, I mean, you guys are playing, and obviously, you know, coming into the Jazz Showcase, you've got a different group. And then you play in a lot of different projects. And then when you play with this project specifically, I mean, playing with Pat playing B3 organ, Byron Landham playing drums, and then Daniel playing percussion, I mean, it's got to be like soloing over like a freight train going down the track because, I mean, that's got to be a gigantic sound. So when you're playing with different groups, do you think differently or is it just a different feel or do you find yourself playing a little differently when you're playing with a B3 organ as opposed to a group that you're coming to the showcase with piano, upright bass, and drum set, or?
Yeah, I mean, I will say the groups that I use, you know, I'm not saying I am criticized because I don't know, because I don't follow that stuff, but I tend to have a family of people that I work with, and they're like hand picked, so they're tailor made. Mm-hmm. And because I'm working towards a sound, and once I get that, I kind of stay with it. So I kind of knew what I was getting beforehand. I will say that there's, you know, I had an opportunity to, both Terrell and myself had an opportunity to have a long tenure with Shirley Scott. So there's a certain amount of there's a tradition that goes along with the organ. That's the other reason for Ode to Billy Joe. Like, if you know anything about the history of the organ in the Hammond B3, one of the things is that almost every record within a certain period had a hit, a jukebox hit on it. And I always try to find, when I would do my records, when I decided to do those type of recordings, I quite often try to find a song that may or may not have been used prevalently. The first time, my first record I did with the organ group, I did Sonny Bono's The Beat Goes On, and I couldn't find that one any other organ record, which made me happy.
Yeah,
because that's the goal. But I did find a couple of Ode to Billy Joe, which just wasn't played the way that we did. You know, and so there's a certain tradition that goes along with that. So I look for players that, you know, everybody that I use has an understanding of that tradition in depth. But the other thing is, if I decide to be more modern and say, hey, let's open up the harmony a bit, like we did on Wade in the Water, I'll have musicians that I know will be able to actually execute that well as well.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's to me, the sound of that B3 organ and that organ group is just something that when you get it right and you're playing and you're playing those groove tunes and all that, like what you said, I mean, I could listen to it all day, you know?
No, I understand. It feels really good to listen to. It's very, very joyous. Again, it's communal. That's my whole thing is that this idea of commune is so important. You're supposed to feel uplifted. You know, I'm not saying that there can't be tunes that are dark and make you have other sort of human experiences, but or emotions that relate to other human experiences. But I think that it's really important to be touched by music in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to find people that just do that innately without any discussion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I mean, for somebody like you who plays in so many groups, but when you find those guys that you can continuously stay with, your playing expands along with theirs. So it's almost like a organic growing, you know, process with everybody's playing. I think when you get a lot of people that pop in and out of groups all the time, and, you know, once in a while they'll play with these guys, and once in a while they'll play with that guy. Nothing wrong with that, but I feel like you can really refine your sound, refine your improvisation, refine your, you know, your whole thought process when you're playing with the same people consistently.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a big difference. I consider myself lucky. I was actually explaining this to someone, I think one of my students the other day, about how I never really have been a hired gun. I've been really blessed with the opportunity to always be asked to play in someone's band because they wanted my sound to be a part of the group. And I know not everybody's had that opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
And now that it's, you know, the music has changed, so you have a lot more people jumping around from group to group. It's harder to keep the group in tour. Well, just the whole idea of the airlines makes it difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just very different now. So I'm very happy that I got the opportunity to do that for so long, and still doing all the things in Terrell's group. So and Lee Smith. I mean, Christian McBride's father, who also plays bass, Lee Smith. I'm in his group, and I'm in a younger musician's group by the name of George Burton, who you will hear about when his record comes out. Next year, you're going to hear about it. It's guaranteed. Everybody's going to be talking about it. But I'm still getting called for the same reason. Like, I want your sound. your sound, I believe that your sound will contribute to the ultimate idea. So I consider myself to be very lucky.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. I mean, to be able to do everything like this and have people actually call you directly and say, hey, you would round out my group. I really want to get you involved in this project. That's got to feel incredible, you know.
Yeah, it does. And you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm not sure how well I do with the hired gun thing because I don't do that as much. I've always done, like, my whole life I've done this, you know. So I have it's a different type of connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've done some, you know, come in and play, and it doesn't feel the same. You just feel like you're kind of reading the changes. It's just a different experience.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. All right, so we should tell everyone crisscrossjazz.com. That's where they can pick up the recording of Jazzland, the new recording, and also timwarfieldmusic.com so they can get more information on where you're playing after you're in Chicago, of course, December 19th yes. through the 22nd at the Jazz Showcase. And, of course, everyone listening to this in Chicago knows it's at 806 South Plymouth Court, jazzshowcase.com. I know Wayne and Joe have shows Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. And then, of course, Joe Siegel's Save the Children matinee at 4 p.m., as he calls it. So yes. That's on Sundays. And we are looking forward to having you in town. And thanks for taking a few minutes, Tim. This has been great, and hopefully I will... I'm going to definitely try to pop over and introduce myself in person when you're in town.
Oh, please do, man. I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
No, definitely. Thanks for jumping on. Of course, everybody, if you want to get more information on anything in Chicago happening in the jazz world, ChicagoJazzMagazine.com, ChicagoJazz.com. You can hear more of these podcasts on every podcast platform that you can possibly think of, so I won't list them all off here. And, of course, if you want to see some of the videos that we do every week, they're available at ChicagoJazz.com. So until next time, hopefully we will see you somewhere out on the scene.